So the last thing is the water left on the back of your hand. You'll take the back of your hand and wipe the back of your neck. Basically, you've economized water completely. Every single drop of water that was present on your hands is actually used to do some sort of pahara. And inclusive of that was wiping the extra portion of the head, because only the first fourth is water. Wiping the ears, which is also a sunnah, and wiping the back of the head, which was mustahab. Or the back of the neck, which was mustahab. And you are not going to wipe the throat. There's nothing in the ahadith to establish the wiping of the throat. And that's why specifically in many books of fiqh it says, dun al-hulkum. It's not the throat. You'll wipe only the back of the neck, not the throat. The next thing that you do once you've finished the head is that you will wash the feet. You do the right side first, and you have to do three times each side. One time is farad, three times is sunnah, and you will also wash up to the ankles, including the ankles. Make sure that you get in between the toes. So what you do for the toes is you take your left pinky and you run it between the toes. And you'll start with the very right toe. So on the right foot, you'll start with a small toe and move towards the middle. And with the left foot, you'll start with the big toe and move towards the left side of the foot. That's the completion of the wudu. So after you've completed the wudu, then you want to recite the following dua. And remember that if you're in the bathroom, you want to recite this in your heart, because you don't want to take the name of Allah in the bathroom, or you may want to step out before you recite this. And so you recite, أَشْهَدُ أَنْ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهِ وَحْدُهُ لَا شَرِيكَ لَهِ وَأَشْهَدُ أَنَّ مُحَمَّدًا عَبْدُهُ وَرَسُولُهُ, testifying to Allah and the Messenger. اللهم اجعلني من التوابين, O Allah, make me from those who are off-turning. وَجَعَلْنِي مِنَ الْمُطَفَّهِرِينَ, and make me from among those who purify themselves. Remember that we know from hadith that this dua opens the eight doors of heaven for you. And then the final thing, if you have the opportunity, is you'll pray two rakat tahiyatul wudu to greet the wudu. That's the wudu in a nutshell. Recall that we spent a whole day talking about, or a whole session talking about, all the benefits of wudu, right? The fact that it washes away the sins, and the fact that it enlightens your body parts, and it opens the doors of Jannah, and it provides you an opportunity to put your footsteps in Jannah. And many of those hadith specifically restrict those benefits to a perfect wudu, to the person who performs the wudu perfectly, properly, fulfilling all of its rights. As much as possible, you want to do the perfect wudu, the best wudu that you can do on each individual occasion. Now, the next discussion that comes in books of fiqh, once you understand how to do the wudu, is, well, who is it mandatory upon? Who is it mandatory upon? And I think it's really interesting that many books of fiqh do it exactly in this order. First, they'll teach you the wudu, and then they'll discuss who it's mandatory upon. And the reason is because everybody should learn it, because eventually it becomes mandatory upon you. So it's not like you should find out whether it's mandatory upon you, so if you're a child, then you shouldn't learn it. You should still teach your children the wudu, even if it's not mandatory upon them. So first, the wudu is taught in many books of fiqh, and then the shurut of taklif, the things that make it mandatory, are then discussed. So it's sort of highlighting that it's important to teach, regardless of whether it's mandatory, and then you can determine whether you have to do it or not. So the very first, there are three conditions that are required in every act of ibadah. So the very first condition is Islam. You have to be a Muslim in order for wudu to be mandatory upon you, and that's obvious. The second is the age of puberty, that you should be above the age of puberty in order to be required to perform the wudu. And the third is that you have to be in a sense of sanity. You can't be in some kind of sickness where you've lost your senses. Those are the three things that are required for almost every ibadah. So for example, for prayer and for wudu, and you'll see it over and over again. The other two acts that are specific to wudu are, number one, freedom from hayd, nifas, and hadath. So what that means is that if a woman is currently having her menstrual cycle, then she cannot perform the wudu and expect it to occur. Right? The wudu is not mandatory upon her because she is still in a state of major impurity. She has to wait till her cycle ends and then take a shower in order to purify herself. She can still perform the wudu, and she can perform the wudu, and many ulama recommend that when a woman is in her cycle, she should perform the wudu, and then after performing the wudu, actually sit on the musalla and make dhikr instead of praying. So as sort of respect for the fact that there are five prayers and keeping up her schedule, But the wudu doesn't do anything technically in the sense that it doesn't open the door to touch the Quran, and it doesn't open the door to pray, because a woman can't pray when she's in that time of the month. Similarly, if a woman is in nifas, nifas means bleeding after childbirth. Can we open the back door? Is it a little cooler? Because it's kind of getting hot. Just maybe crank it open so that cool air comes in. Or maybe you can turn the fan on slow speed. So, the other thing to keep in mind is nifas. Once a woman gives birth to a child, there is bleeding that occurs after the child is born. And that bleeding occurs can continue for many days, but the Sharia restricts it to 40 days. So within the first 40 days, any bleeding that occurs after childbirth is called nifas. And during that period of time, a woman also enters a state of major ritual impurity, which actually means she can't pray, she can't enter the masjid, she can't fast, and we'll talk about it in more detail soon. But in that case, when she's in nifas, she doesn't need to perform the wudu, because obviously the wudu doesn't do anything for her in the sense that it won't open the door to salah, and it won't open the door to the Quran. Finally, if you're in a state where you are releasing something that causes you to become impure, then you're not going to do the wudu at that time. Okay? So those are the three main things that you need. Freedom from hayd, freedom from nifas, and freedom from hadath. Now, the last thing that you need in order to perform the wudu is you need presence of water. Obviously, you need water. If you don't have water, you can't perform the wudu, and it's a blessing that of the Sharia upon us that when water is not available, we can still purify ourselves, but we do it by something called tayammum. And tayammum means to purify yourself with earth, with types of earth, for example, sand or dust or dirt. And we'll talk about the ayah and the basis of that in a future lesson. The next thing is, what's the result of the wudu? Once you do the wudu, what does that do? It does two things. Number one, it opens the door to prayer. Once you have the wudu, then you are allowed to pray. And number two, it opens the door to touching the Qur'an. You cannot touch the Qur'an except in a state of wudu. It is makruh tahrimi to touch the Qur'an without a state of wudu. Another way to sort of categorize the wudu is to look at wudu and say, okay, when is wudu farad? When is it mandatory? When is it wajib? And when is it recommended? So let's look at it that way. Wudu is farad for any salah. If you want to pray a farad salah, if you want to pray a nafil salah, if you want to pray janazah, any salah that you want, you need to have wudu. So that's the first time that wudu is mandatory. Wudu is also mandatory for sajda of tilawa. Sajda of tilawa means there are certain places in the Quran where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has commanded us to make a sajda due to the ayah that is being recited, based on its meaning and based on the fact that the Prophet ﷺ told us to do so. So in those cases, you need to have wudu in order to perform that sajda. The last thing that you need to have wudu for is to touch an ayah of the Qur'an. If you want to touch an ayah of the Qur'an, you need to have wudu. Now keep in mind, if you want to read the ayah, you don't need wudu. If you memorize some Qur'an and you want to read it, you don't need wudu. You need wudu to touch it. Reading it is okay without wudu. Remember a couple things under this particular discussion. The very first thing is that Bismillah is an ayah. In and of itself, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim is an ayah. So if you have, for example, some piece of jewelry which says Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim on it, and you're wearing that, if it's in the case of a woman, like maybe like a gold necklace that says that, then that can't touch you when you're not in a state of wudu. That's an ayah of the Qur'an. So you need to be especially careful in that instance. The other thing to note is that if you want to touch the Qur'an, sometimes the mushaf, the actual copy of the Qur'an, has a cover on it. If that cover is attached to the Qur'an, it counts as a part of that mushaf and you can't touch it. But if the cover is can be separated from the mushaf, from the copy of the Qur'an, then you can touch it. So you'll see, like, for example, sometimes the Qur'an has a cloth wrapped around it. In some places, when they sell the Qur'an, the mushaf of the Qur'an, there's a cloth wrapped around it. You can touch that without wudu, because that cloth is separate from the Qur'an. Other times you'll see that the Qur'an comes in that small box, right? And you shake the box a little bit and the actual mushaf comes out and the box separates. You can touch that box while the Qur'an is in it without wudu. But if the Qur'an is laying on a desk, the mushaf is laying on a desk, and it has a cover on it, which does, right, that's not the Qur'an, that cardboard cover, the book cover, you cannot touch that because it's bound to the Qur'an, So it counts as part of the mushaf. Yeah, what's the question?
Can you fold it with some fold?
So we're about to get there. So then the next question is let's say that there is a mushaf which is just sitting free without any cover on it, and you need to pick it up. So for example, it's sitting on a table and you want to sit on the couch and you don't want to put your feet above the mushaf, so you want to pick it up and put it on a higher shelf. So in that case, you have a couple options. Number one is you can go and perform the wudu, obviously, and then that'll open the door to touching the Qur'an. Number two, you can take a separate piece of cloth that is not connected to you. Like, for example, you go and get maybe like a dust cloth or something that's clean, and you can pick up the mushaf with that cloth and put it on a higher shelf. The thing you can't do is you can't take your own shirt. Like if you have a qamis, you can't take the shirt and pick it up because the qamis is considered attached to you. So therefore, you cannot use that qamis to pick up the Qur'an, the mushaf. You need a separate cloth to pick it up if you don't want to make a wudu in order to pick it up. The other thing that's important in this particular discussion is that it is not makruh to give a copy of the Qur'an to a young child. It's not makruh to give a copy of the Qur'an to the young child. It is not mandatory on that child to make wudu. So it's not makruh for that child to hold a copy of the Qur'an. It's better for that child to learn how to make the wudu and to inculcate in that child the necessity of making wudu before you touch that book, but it's not mandatory. It's permissible. It's not considered even disliked to hand a child a mushaf when he is not in a state of wudu. The final thing that I want to mention is that if there is a copy of the Holy Qur'an and it has more English than it has the ayat in it, for example, some of these translations that have tons and tons of English and then just a couple ayahs on a page, you can touch that without wudu. That is considered predominantly English. And so when it's predominantly English, you can touch the book. But you cannot touch the individual ayah on the page. So if you're going to read it, you're not going to run your finger across the Arabic because you cannot touch the ayah itself. You can touch the book because it's dominated by English, but you can't touch the ayah itself. So those are the three times when wudu is mandatory. There's no way around it. Number one, for salah. Number two, for sajda of tilawa. And for number three, for touching an ayah of the Qur'an. That's when it's mandatory, meaning farad. Then there's a couple times when it's wajib, when it's basically essential. You have to do it. It's a little bit less in necessity, but it's still mandatory. And we spoke about this when we talked about what do we mean by wajib and what do we mean by farad in a previous lesson. So it is wajib to do tawaf of the Kaaba. If you want to do tawaf of the Kaaba, it is wajib to be in a state of wudu. The last thing to keep in mind is that when is wudu recommended? When are the times that our Sharia has recommended that we actually do wudu? So the very first is when you touch books of knowledge. The Sharia places our tradition places a high emphasis on knowledge because our books of knowledge are derived from Quran and Hadith. You know, we're not like other people, we just write what we think. And it has no basis, and I think this, so let me write this, and you think that, so let me write that. Our knowledge is based from Quran and Hadith, and deep understanding of the Quran and the Hadith. So any book of knowledge, out of respect, it's better to be in a state of wudu when you touch that book of knowledge. The second time is for renewal for each salah. Every time you are going to do a new salah, it's best to make a fresh wudu. Why? Because although you may still have wudu, spiritually, remember we talked about the two aspects of wudu, the spiritual aspect of the wudu may have been broken. You may have looked at some non-mahram on the way to the masjid or at some place outside at work. You may have done something wrong with your tongue. You may have walked towards some sin. So take advantage of purifying yourself over and over again for each and every salah. In fact, the Prophet ﷺ was so regular in making a fresh wudu for each and every salah that many of the Sahaba did not even realize that you could pray more than one salah with one wudu until almost the eighth year after the hijrah. It was the seventh or eighth year after the hijrah that the one time the Prophet ﷺ prayed more than one salah with a single wudu, and some of the Sahaba approached him and said, "Ya Rasulullah, has the law changed? Has the Sharia changed that I see you now praying two salah with one wudu?" And then the Prophet ﷺ then explained to them that no, you can pray as many salah as possible with one wudu. And by salah, I mean different salah, like Fajr, Dhuhr, Asr. Not for every sunnah and every nafil within Fajr or within Dhuhr, within Asr. For each new salah time, to make a new wudu. The next time that wudu is recommended is to exit from the khilaf of the ulama. Now, this is a little bit particular, and it doesn't really apply to the common people as much as it applies to people who are going to be imams and people who are more knowledgeable, because it's very difficult to begin with to learn your own madhab, right? And then beyond that, to require people to learn all the other madhab would be too difficult. But for example, Imam Shafi'i has a rule within his madhab that if you touch a woman or a woman touches you, then your wudu breaks. So for example, you go to the store, you go to Walgreens, and you purchase something, and when the woman gives you back, you know, 50 cents change, if her finger touches your hand, according to the Shafi'i madhab, your wudu broke. And according to the Hanafi madhab, your wudu did not break. Because the Hanafi madhab, well, we're not going to go into details, but just get that general idea, so I can explain this concept. So if you're going to be the imam in the masjid, then it's better for you to make wudu in order to accommodate all the madhabs so that everybody can feel comfortable praying behind you. So that a Shafi'i can feel, yes, his wudu is also valid within my madhab. And also it allows you to be as careful as possible. Because Imam Shafi'i himself was a great scholar. He was a great scholar, and his madhab is just as valid as Imam Abu Hanifa's madhab. And so we should respect these madhabs because they're actually interpreting the same thing. So there is a possibility of interpreting the ayah of Aula Mastumun Nisa, which is the basis of why Imam Shafi'i says that your wudu breaks. There is a way of interpreting it such that your wudu would break if a woman touched your hand. So in order to fall under all safety, to be as safe as possible in your wudu, you should look at the other madahib and see as much as you can join together so that you avoid any possibility of your wudu being broken. And this, the best way to do it is when you perform the full wudu, the full sunnah wudu, and you perform a wudu after every salah, you basically exited from 95% of all the difference between the ulama anyway. So that's the ideal scenario, and like we've spoken of. The next time that it's recommended to do wudu is for sleep. Before you go to bed, it's a sunnah of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam to do wudu. Now, so many people come and ask me, they say, how can I sleep less? How can I decrease the amount of sleep? Every time I sleep 8-9 hours, and I still wake up feeling like I could sleep 8 or 9 more. And one of the secrets to decreasing your amount of sleep is to increase the barakah in your sleep. And the way you increase the barakah in your sleep is you follow the sunnah of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam within your sleep. In everything, that's how you bring barakah into everything. Every single thing in your life will be increased by following the sunnah. So what are some of the sunnah of sleep? Now I'm not going to give you a complete list, but just briefly. For example, doing wudu before you go to sleep. Praying 2 rak'ah before you go to sleep. Facing the qibla when you sleep. Lying on your right side when you go to sleep. And making sure you don't lie on your stomach when you go to sleep. Making the dua of sleep. So all of these things, they increase the barakah. They attract Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's mercy towards you. And they make your few hours of sleep as if you slept for hours and hours and hours. And they make you extremely fresh. This is why the Prophet ﷺ didn't need to sleep much. Because his sleep was connected with Allah. And when you connect something with Allah, you're on a whole different level. And the Sahaba subsequently, they didn't need to sleep that much. Because they connected their sleep to the Prophet. And the Prophet ﷺ had already connected his sleep to Allah. So they fell into that chain. And our tradition continues along that chain. So in anything you do, in eating, in sleeping, in everything that you do, you should always keep in mind the sunnahs of the Prophet ﷺ, because in essence, they are the best thing for you. They increase the barakah in that act. Also, it's sunnah to do wudu when you wake up. Immediately when you wake up, it's sunnah to do wudu, even if you don't intend to pray right away. And finally, it's sunnah to do wudu after every error, after every act of ghafla, after every act of heedlessness. So if you're sitting with a bunch of friends and everybody is just laughing out of control, you know, that kind of laughter that you can't even hold it back if you want to. In that case, you should make wudu afterwards. Because that you sort of became very, very heedless of Allah at that moment. Because you wouldn't have laughed like that if you would have complete reality at that time of the fact that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, how powerful He is and what kind of punishment He's prepared on the Day of Judgment. We won't be laughing there, guaranteed. So because we lost our consciousness of that for a moment, it's as if we slept for a moment, right? And sleep breaks the wudu. So it's not mandatory to make the wudu, But when you fall asleep on your duty to Allah, fall asleep on the job, right, in that way, in the sense that you lose the, you become heedless for a moment, in that case, it's mandub. It's recommended that you make wudu. And especially after any sin. If you've committed a major sin with your eyes and you want to wash away those effects on your, off your heart, an excellent way to do so is to make wudu. Now keep in mind that although wudu is an ibadah, it's not an independent ibadah. So you cannot just sit and do wudu all day as, just because you feel like doing more wudu. You have to use the wudu in order to make another wudu. So for example, you woke up for Fajr and you made wudu, you went to the masjid, and you went to the masjid and you prayed Fajr. Then for Dhuhr you can make a new wudu. So for Dhuhr you make a new wudu. Now after Dhuhr you can't say, I want to make my body parts shine even more, let me make it two more wudus. No. You have to use the wudu for a prayer time before you can make another wudu. So those are the three categories of wudu. So wudu is farad for any salah, for tilawa, for sajda of tilawa, and for touching any ayah of the Quran. Wudu is wajib for tawaf, and wudu is recommended for number one, touching books of knowledge, number two, renewal for each salah, number three, exiting from the differences of ulama, number four, when you go to sleep, number five, when you wake up, and number six, after every error or after some kind of heedlessness or ghafla from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now this is not, this recommended part, this is not an all-inclusive list. There are other things, but I've touched on the major points in order for you to be able to take something out of this without coming up with a huge list. Now let's move to the breakers of wudu. What are the things that break your wudu? Anything that exits from the urinary tract or the rectal tract will break wudu. Anything. If that thing is pure, naturally, it still breaks your wudu because it came out. And if it's impure, it obviously breaks your wudu. So let me give you an example. A pure thing, mucus. If you sneeze and mucus comes out of your nose, that doesn't break your wudu. Mucus is a pure thing. But if mucus comes out of your rectal tract, it breaks your wudu. So that's the first thing that would break your wudu. Anything that comes out of the urinary path or the rectal path. So obviously urine, stool, and mucus and these type of things. Anything that comes out from the sibi lane breaks your wudu. Another thing to keep in mind that breaks your wudu that's relatively common but people get confused about is if, for example, you see something, let's say by accident you see something and it excites you, okay, and some fluid comes out, like the pre-intercourse, the fluid that comes out. So if you see something and it excites you, by accident you see something you shouldn't have seen and you become excited sexually, and some little bit of fluid comes out, then that breaks your wudu. It doesn't require ghusl. It only breaks your wudu. You need ghusl when you have, you know, you are fully excited and everything comes out with force. That requires ghusl. But this little bit that comes out, that doesn't require ghusl. That requires wudu. Similarly, some people, when they actually urinate, when after they urinate, sometimes some thick white fluid comes out. You know, a little bit thicker white fluid, especially when they're trying to clean themselves properly. Sometimes a little bit extra thick white fluid comes out. That does not require ghusl. That requires wudu. And when we get to ghusl, we'll talk in more detail. But these two things require... I'm specifically mentioning them because often people ask, and I mean, it's sort of a little bit weird topic to talk about, but it's part of the Sharia, so we should talk about it and we should share that knowledge. The second thing that breaks your wudu is any impurity that comes from anywhere else in the body. So anything that came out of the urinary path or the rectal path broke your wudu, whether it was pure or impure, but if you're talking about the rest of the body, it has to be an impurity. What do I mean by that? For example, blood is an impurity. If blood comes out from a wound, and it flows across that wound, it has to come out of the body, it has to flow across the wound, it breaks your wudu. So if you get a paper cut, you have a piece of paper and you get a paper cut, you see a line of red along the cut, but the blood doesn't cross the wound, it doesn't break your wudu. Only after it crosses the wound does it break your wudu. Similarly, if you happen to rub your finger and your finger goes a little bit inside your nose, and when you pull it out you see a dab of blood, a little dot of blood, that does not break the wudu. It has to be thin and it has to flow across from your nose for your wudu to be broken. Similarly, if you brush your teeth and after you brush your teeth, you spit out and you see a thin streak of blood. That does not break your wudu. The blood has to dominate over the saliva. If there's more blood than there is spit, then that breaks your wudu. If it's less, it does not break your wudu. So the blood has to actually exit, has to flow, it has to cross the wound, and it has to be enough to actually break your wudu. Same thing with vomit. If you vomit up, vomit breaks the wudu. But it has to be a mouthful of vomit. If you vomit up a little bit and then you feel like you're going to throw up and it actually goes back down, that does not break your wudu. It has to be a mouthful, meaning it's so much that it fills your mouth and you have to get it out because you can't contain it. That is when your wudu breaks. So anything that is najasa, like blood or pus or vomit, and if it goes across the wound and dominates, then and only then does it break your wudu. One thing that people often do that they don't think about is if you have like a pimple and you press it and it breaks, the pus that comes out from there crosses the pimple, that breaks your wudu. You have to go and make a fresh wudu because you've exited an impurity, which is pus, from your skin. So keep that in mind. People often overlook that point. The next thing that breaks your wudu is sleep. Sleep breaks your wudu if you sleep without your rear end planted on the ground. So if you lie on your side, that breaks your wudu. Or if you sit like this, you know, with your feet on the ground and your knees to your chest, so your feet are flat on the ground and your knees are in your chest and you're sitting folded like this, that and you fall asleep, that would break your wudu. If you are sleeping and with seated, then you have to ask more questions. So somebody comes to you and says, I was sitting and I fell asleep. Did my wudu break? Then the next question is, were you leaning against something or not? If you were leaning against something and you were in such a deep sleep that were that thing to be pulled away, you would fall down, your wudu broke. But if you weren't leaning against something and you were just sitting like this, you know, sitting, let's for example, Indian style, with your rear end planted on the ground, your wudu does not break. Okay? So just assume yourself as, you know, somebody coming to ask you, because then it makes the situation easier. Somebody says, I fell asleep, did my wudu break? So the next question you ask them is, how are you sleeping? If they say, I was sleeping on my side, it broke. If they say, I was sleeping without my rear end planted in any way, it broke. If they say, well, actually, I was sitting and my rear end was planted on the ground, then you ask the next question. Okay, were you leaning against something or not? If they were leaning against something, the wudu breaks. And if not, if they were sitting planted, like in Indian style, for example, with their rear end planted, the wudu does not break. The other thing to keep in mind is that if you're sitting like this and, for example, you fall for a second, right? You're very tired, you fall for a second, and then you get back up, your wudu does not break. You have to actually lose consciousness for a moment. And the reason why the wudu breaks in this is actually because small amounts of gas can leak out of your body. When you fall asleep, your sphincter relaxes a bit. And so gas can actually come out and you wouldn't even know. So that's why sleep breaks the wudu. So the first two principles are the main principles. That if anything comes out of the front or back path, that breaks the wudu. And if anything impure comes out from the body, that breaks the wudu. Everything else falls under that. So sleep falls under because air most likely came out from your rear end. So that's why it breaks the wudu. Fainting, same reason. It breaks the wudu. Insanity, same reason. Okay, because you don't know what's going on if you've lost sanity for a moment. That breaks your wudu. Intoxication. If somebody becomes drunk, that breaks their wudu. Because obviously they're not being able to control and realize what's going on with their rear end. And finally, laughter in salah. Laughter in salah is actually interesting. If you laugh in salah, and you laugh so that only you could, let's take three scenarios, let's work our way up. So you're praying. Let's say you smile while you're praying. If you smile while you're praying but hold it back, nothing happens. If you laugh loud enough that you can hear, but the person next to you cannot hear, your salah breaks, but your wudu does not break. And if you laugh so loud that you can hear it and the person next to you can hear it, then both your salah and your wudu broke. And the basis of this is actually a hadith about a hadith from the time of the Prophet ﷺ, in which the Sahaba were actually praying behind the Prophet ﷺ, and when they were praying behind the Prophet ﷺ, there was a blind companion who came into the masjid. And as he was walking into the masjid, he fell into a small pit in the masjid. So how about Sina saw that and started laughing, that this person fell in a pit. So they started laughing, and after the Salah, the Prophet ﷺ turned around and told them, go remake your wudu and go remake the Salah. So because of this, if you laugh in the Salah, then your wudu and your Salah break. You have to remake both. Finally, the last thing that breaks wudu is that if the private parts touch, but there's no insertion. So if a male and a female's private part touch, not with cloth between. If there's cloth between, any kind of barrier between, it doesn't break the wudu. But if the two private parts directly touch, without actual insertion, then the wudu breaks. If you get to the level of insertion, then the ghusl also becomes mandatory. Okay? Then you have to actually take a legal bath. You can't purify yourself with just wudu. Now, what's really interesting about this is that I think this is interesting because you look at number six. Six says intoxication. So that's actually really, really interesting, because why would the fuqaha write intoxication? We're not even supposed to drink. It's haram. So why even mention it? And actually, it's just a beautiful principle that's being illustrated, and that is that if somebody drinks or has the problem of drinking, that doesn't take them out of the fold of Islam. They're still Muslims. They will still pray. They're still our brothers. We will still make excuses for them. So if somebody has a drinking problem, you know, it's just one problem. We have problems too. Just as much as they have an addiction to something, we're addicted to something else. They're addicted to drinking, we're addicted to the internet. They're addicted to drinking, we might be addicted to looking at everything that walks in front of us. So everybody has problems. That doesn't mean that now the Sharia doesn't apply to them at all. They've left the fold of Islam. Get them out of the masjid. No. They still have to know the rules of the Sharia, and they have to apply it to their lives. They can't help these things sometimes. Sometimes it's very, very difficult. You know, I mean, it's for us, it's unimaginable. How can somebody drink? But think about somebody who's more righteous than us. They say, how can somebody not come to the masjid five times a day? Right? What kind of diseased people are those? So everybody has their own level of disease depending on how you look at it. We may look at the person who drinks and call him diseased, and yet so many people may look at us and say, look how foolishly diseased these people are. How can this guy go and look at everything that crosses his path? You know, what's wrong with him? How can he waste 8 hours on the internet a day? He doesn't even read the Quran. He should get out of the masjid too. So the Sharia, the fuqaha, were very, very beautiful in the way they derived their fiqh. They included everybody, because everybody remains within the fold of Islam. That's Allah's mercy. Who knows on the day of judgment whether Allah take all of somebody's bad deeds and turn them into good, and Allah can take all the righteous people and throw them into the hellfire if He wants. He's Allah. You cannot give Him the Quran and say, you have to follow this. He's Allah. He's above and beyond anything. Nobody can make anything mandatory upon Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So we are all dependent on Allah's mercy. Never look at somebody with a disease and say, oh, you know, I'm better than that person. At the same time, we are not going to look down upon somebody who testifies to Allah and His Messenger. Always remember that. Because when you get into that circumstance, where you start criticizing those people whose tongue testifies to the Shahada, you're playing a very dangerous ball game. You are playing a very dangerous ball game, because you don't know if you might upset Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by messing with that person. Allah takes the mu'min, or at least Allah takes the Muslim, right? And has a very, very high view of that person who takes the Shahada. It's a very valuable word. A very valuable word. It changes things tremendously. So when somebody has the Shahada on their tongue, we should never criticize them. We should never find a fault in them. And believe it or not, let me tell you another thing. Al-mu'minu mir'atul mu'min. That the mu'min is the mirror of another mu'min. When you look at somebody and you see the fault in somebody, it's not their fault. You're actually seeing yourself. It's your own fault within you that is being reflected through them. That's a very, very deep concept, and if you reflect on it, you'll understand it. But actually, we all have faults. We all have these diseases. So never, ever criticize anybody else, because you never know who will make tawbah tomorrow and become a wali of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You never know. You never know. So always, always show your wing of mercy, make 70 excuses for your brothers and sisters, and always overlook the faults of others, and turn that characteristic of finding faults into yourself, inshallah. So this is just a beautiful lesson from the fiqh. You know, the fiqh is deeply, deeply tied into this whole tradition. They didn't make these things up randomly. These fuqaha understood what they were doing when they were coming up with these laws. The last thing I'd like to mention for this class is that there are things that don't break the wudu, which people commonly think do break the wudu, or they ask about it, so I thought we should cover them. Although it's not often listed in different books of fiqh, but for example, cutting the hair. Well, let me just teach you couple principles first, and then let's just test each other on these. So the principle is that impurity has to come from your body. Something impure has to exit from your body in order to break the wudu. Two main principles. An impure thing, number one, has to exit from your body, number two. So, let's take an example. A man goes to get a haircut. He gets his haircut, that does not break the wudu. Something exited from his body, yes, but it was not impure. Hair is not impure. Similarly, somebody clips their nails. It does not break the wudu. Something exited from his body, yes, but it was not impure. Similarly, you see someone else's private parts, or a woman touches your hand. Nothing exited from the body, and no impurity was involved, so it does not break the wudu. Similarly, you have a two-year-old child. That two-year-old child soils their diaper. And you go and you wash the child and clean them. You wash away all the najasa from their body. That does not break the wudu. Nothing impure exited from your own body, so it does not break the wudu. And finally, if you peel away, let's say you have a little bit of a scab, and you peel away some skin from that scab. Now, skin came off your body, but skin is not impure. It is pure. Therefore, it did not break your wudu. So always keep this general principle in mind. Now, let me touch upon one thing, the last point I want to make. And that is that now we've started getting into these various sort of, more, I don't know how you say it in English, but light masail. You know, things that are a little bit more touchy. And you can't make an exhaustive list. There will always be weird things that will happen to you in your life where you won't be able to come up with an answer. So the only goal of this class is that you take home general principles and you learn the most common things that could occur to you every day, or that might occur in your life every day. But what I really want to inculcate in you is that you use the ulama and the muftis within our community and around the world in order to seek more knowledge. When you have a situation, don't try to come up with it on your own if it's not common. Always seek the assistance of the ulama. That's always the best way because they have the information that you need. Now, if you look in Chicago, subhanAllah, there's so many muftis in Chicago. There are so many muftis in Chicago, perhaps even more than some countries in the Middle East. True muftis who just do iftah all day, who are fully trained in 3 or 4 years of mufti training, they write fatwas all day, this is their job. You don't find these people in many countries. Not even 1, 2, 3 perhaps sometimes. Yet in Chicago alone, there are so many muftis, subhanAllah. It's just a huge blessing. So we should take advantage of them. On the Day of Judgment we'll be asked, did you approach the people of knowledge and ask them? Right? We're commanded in the Quran to ask the people who know if you don't know. Meaning ask the people of knowledge. So while I presented general principles here, you still need to ask people that you don't, in cases where you may not know. And even if you do know, go and ask. Because sometimes just the barakah of that person's words will make it easy for you to act on it. And we talked about this in one of the previous lessons. So he may say to you, yes, you have to do wudu after that fluid comes out of you if you see someone. Right? If you see a non-mahram and you get a little bit excited and some white fluid comes out. And maybe before you were a little bit lazy in that fact, but because it came from his tongue and there was some barakah in it, it may actually hit you in the heart and get inside this thick skull of ours, and we may be able to act on it in a better way. So always act and seek information from those people who are trained, because when they're trained, they're not trained by themselves. They're trained from their teacher, who was 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 trained by the Tabi'in, who was trained by the Tabi'in, who was trained by the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, who was trained by the angel Jibra'il, who was trained by Allah Subhanahu Wa Ta'ala. So this is a silsila, a chain. We have a chain of our knowledge. It's connected. We don't just make things up. So it's a great blessing on us to be able to have this type of information available in Chicago. So use all those people in Chicago who know. Approach them, sit with them, talk to them, discuss with them. That's how these things will become second nature in your life, inshaAllah. So with that, we'll close. وآخر الدعوانا أن الحمد لله رب العالمين. Okay, so now if there's questions, let's take them.
What hand do you do?
You do khilal of the beard with the right hand. So the question is, when you do khilal of the beard, what hand do you do it with? You do it with the right hand, and you're supposed to do it 3 times. 1, 2, 3.
What time will you do with that?
When you're washing the face. You'll do the khilal of the beard when you're washing the face.
When is it preferred to do the miswak before or after you rinse your mouth?
It's preferred to do the miswak before you rinse your mouth.
Say I was in some sports game and I sweat a lot. Would I have to do a
Okay, so you tell me. Something exited from your body, right? Which is sweat. Is sweat pure or impure?
Pure.
You know, it's pure. Sweat is pure. It smells, but it's pure. So, sweat is pure. Okay?
You mentioned can you reiterate, like, when, while you're in an amaz, the shaitan comes and pushes you from the back? Can you reiterate about that?
Yeah, so one of the things to keep in mind about wudu is that once you make wudu, wudu is 100% certain. You don't, okay, well, let's think about this one. So you're praying salah, right? And the funny thing about salah, and the Prophet ﷺ actually mentioned this in a hadith, by the way, is that during salah, you feel like little bubbles of air are coming out from your backside. And you never feel it any other time. You can be talking to your friends, you can be jogging, you can be boxing. You won't feel like anything's coming out. But in salah, you have this feeling like sometimes things are coming out, these small bubbles. And the reason is the Prophet ﷺ said that when a person prays, shaitan goes to his backside and begins pulling to make him feel like his wudu is broken, to distract him. So in that case, you do not, your wudu does not break. You have to be 100% certain that your wudu breaks. Now let me take the other extreme. Some people, they're very avid fans of reading hadith and interpreting themselves. They say, they actually will read the hadith that says that your wudu does not break until you smell it or hear it. So they'll release tons of gas, and they don't smell it, and they don't hear it, so they say that my wudu didn't break. That's not what that hadith means. What the hadith is saying is that you have to be 100% certain that gas passed. Not that you have to hear it literally and smell it literally. Sometimes it doesn't smell. Sometimes you may not hear it. If you are certain, 100%, then your wudu broke. Otherwise, it didn't break. That's what that hadith means.
So that's only in namaz or generally speaking?
Well, this happens in salah, because shaitan comes and bothers you in salah because he wants to distract you. So first he tries to screw you up on how many rak'ah, and then he tries to screw you up in this. So he's trying to knock you out from every direction, because salah, you know why salah is so dangerous for shaitan? Because in salah you do sajda. And not only do you do it once, you do it twice. And the thing that Iblis didn't do that made him shaitan was he refused to do sajda. He hates salah. That's the thing that he didn't do that we do. Now you think about, actually think about it another way. Imagine that Iblis became shaitan because he didn't pray, he didn't make one sajda. So what do you think about the person who every day denies sajda when he doesn't pray? Right? The people who don't pray, five times a day they don't pray. So imagine that, how Allah must look at them. In fact, we know that, you know, it's a very bad situation for someone to be in that state.
When you wipe your head, should you do it three times or once?
When you wipe your head, you only wipe once, not three times, once.
The routine shower, so regardless of the order, for example, take a shower, go to work, and I think I need to pray now. You said I have wudu.
If you take a shower in the morning without any thought of wudu, and subsequently go to work, because you fulfilled all four body parts, as listed in the Quran, you have wudu. And according to the Hanafi madhab, the niyyah is not necessary, and according to the Hanafi madhab, the order is not necessary. Niyyah is sunnah, and order is sunnah. So even if you washed your feet first and then washed your head, it still counts as a wudu. Now that wudu is not rewarded, but it is usable to pray and touch the Quran.
The mushaf is open and you don't have wudu, can you read it?
So the question is, if the mushaf is sitting open before you and you don't have wudu, can you read it? You can ask the madrasakids what they do. You can read it. Yeah, you can read it, because you haven't touched it. And actually, some of these guys are very slick, exactly. They're very slick, they don't want to get up and do wudu because they're tired. So then they take their pen and they start turning, changing the pages with their pen. So, you know, that's permissible. Your wudu, you know. No. You cannot touch it with your hand. That's the key thing.
If you just made the wudu and suddenly you feel that you have to pass gas, and you try to control it, it's really forceful, and you try to pick it, but is it okay to let it flow and do the wudu again, or try to stop it?
No, if you have to go to the washroom very, very badly, or it's gas or anything, just you should go ahead and relieve yourself and then go ahead and make the wudu again. Mm-hmm. Oh. And it happens. I mean, actually, people are laughing, but it's a pretty serious thing, because a lot of people, they have to go to the bathroom, but they say, no, I'm going to go pray first. Right? And so they're sitting there and they're focused in the whole prayer, and the whole focus is holding in their najasa. So that's considered makruh. That's considered dislike.
Bismillah ar-Rahman. Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, idha kumtu minas salati, faqsilu wujuhakum, wa aydiyakum ilal marafiqi, wamsahu bi ru'usikum, wa arjulakum ilal ka'bain. This is the ayah that we've discussed over and over again, and we've been commenting on this throughout the past 4 or 5 days. Before I actually begin, I want to make a couple comments. First of all, yesterday, I just want to clarify one thing. When we talked about the sunan of wudu, actually how to perform the wudu from beginning to end, I mentioned that part of it is first you wash your hands, then you rinse your mouth to the back of the throat, and then you wash to the back of your nose 3 times. All of that is established by the sunnah. After I mentioned those steps, I said, and one of the neat things about these 3 steps is that they allow you to check the water. That's not why they're there. That's just an extra way to think about it. But those acts are all established by the sunnah. There are clear hadith establishing those acts. So I want to make sure that people understand how those acts are established within our sharia. It so happens that if you reflect on those acts, you see that they tie in with water beautifully. But that's just a secondary thing. The reason why we do it is because we're following the footsteps of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He did it, and so we do it. What I want to discuss today is something that isn't specifically part of the wudu, but it comes under the discussion of wudu, and it's actually a very, very important discussion because it affects many of us in the way we perform our wudu, and that is wiping over leather socks. It's unique or interesting that when you look at books of fiqh, the book of wiping over leather socks is always separate from the actual wudu itself. It's always separate. So they'll discuss the wudu, and they'll discuss many aspects of wudu, and then there'll always be a separate chapter, or often there'll be a separate chapter, which discusses the wiping over leather socks. And the reason is because if you really think about it and reflect on wiping over leather socks for a moment, it seems contrary to the entire act of wudu in this way. See, the Quran tells you to do 4 things. The Quran tells you, إِذَا كُمْتُمْ إِلَى الصَّلَاةِ فَاغْسِلُوا وُجُوهَكُمْ, wash your faces, وَأَيْدِيَكُمْ إِلَى الْمَرَافِقِ, and wash your hands to your including your elbows, وَامْسَحُوا بِرُؤُوسِكُمْ, and wipe your heads, وَأَرْجُلَكُمْ إِلَى الْكَعْبَيْنِ, and wash your feet, including your ankles. So now here is the Holy Quran commanding you that you have to wash your feet. You're being commanded to wash your feet, so how can you wipe over them? How can you wipe over socks? How can the Quran tell you you have to wash your feet, and it's commanding you to wash your feet, and then you go ahead and wipe over your socks? How can you break an ayah of the Quran? So that should be the question that popped up in your mind, and actually that's one of the reasons why this is a separate discussion. Because initially, actually, Imam Abu Hanifa said you cannot wipe, like when Imam Abu Hanifa was originally developing his fiqh, he said it is not permissible to wipe over your leather socks. I will not permit it, because the ayah of the Holy Quran has, well, as we've discussed on several occasions, tawatur. The ayah of the Holy Quran was repeated in front of so many different sahaba on so many different occasions and recited at so many different times that hundreds of sahaba transmitted that ayah that you have to wash your feet. And Imam Abu Hanifa said, at that point he had only received a few reports of wiping over leather socks. So he said, and I only have a few reports here and there of people wiping over leather socks, so therefore I cannot equal those two things. The Quran is still the first source. And so the Quran says wash your feet, so you have to wash your feet. That was the original thinking of Imam Abu Hanifa. Then what happened was more and more and more reports began to reach Imam Abu Hanifa of so many sahaba wiping their feet that it became at the level of tawatur. The idea of wiping over socks, the idea of wiping over leather socks reached the level of tawatur. And so based on that, when so many ahadith about wiping over leather socks came from so many different companions, that then it reached the level of tawatur. It reached the level of 100% certainty and proof, such that there was no doubt that had occurred. Then, because hadith is also wahi, just like Quran, it is then permissible to wipe over leather socks. And in fact, Imam Abu Hanifa said, in his own words, مَا قُلْتُ بِالْمَسْحِ, I did not permit masha over the leather socks, حَتَّى جَاءَنِي, until it came to me, مِثْلَ النِّهَارِ, until it came to me like the light of day. Meaning until I had so many narrations from so many different companions that they were all wiping over leather socks, then and only then did I permit it, because then at that point it reaches tawatur. And once it reaches tawatur, then Qur'an equals hadith. The big difference between Qur'an and hadith is that the Qur'an has all tawatur, every ayah of the Qur'an has tawatur, whereas the majority of hadith don't have tawatur. So you can have a sahih hadith, and it might be correct,
but it still doesn't reach the level of so many Sahaba saying it and so many Sahaba transmitting it and it being very, very common knowledge among everybody. That's why Imam Abu Hanifa said this. And in fact, if you look at it, over 80 companions actually narrate that about wiping over leather socks. And of those 80, 10 of them are from Ashara Mubashara, you know, the 10 who were promised Jannah. This is something that has come from so many different chains of transmission, and so many people have narrated it, and it was done on so many different occasions, that therefore it is permissible to wipe over leather socks. Now, given that background, wiping over leather socks will be exactly that. It is only permitted in the case of leather socks. Because the Quran is saying you have to wash. And the way you're getting around it is with leather socks from all these different narrators. You have so many narrations about leather socks. So therefore, you can only wipe if you're wearing leather socks. In fact, there are three conditions that you have to match. Either the sock has to be leather, and it has to cover the ankle. Now, when we say leather socks, what we're talking about is a sock made of leather which subsequently covers the ankle. It rises up and covers the ankle. That's what we mean by leather sock, and most of you have seen it. But if it's not a leather sock, then it has to match the characteristics of a leather sock. Number one, it has to be water resistant. Number two, it has to stand on its own. And number three, it has to be permissible to walk a good distance in that sock without it tearing. And many ulama say 1 mile, 2 mile, and it would be on sand, not on concrete. These three conditions have to be found in a sock before you can wipe over it. Number one, it has to be thick enough that it stands on its own. It has to have its own form. Is Amjad here? Or is he actually left? Okay. Because he has a very, very nice example of a sock like that. Here, let me see the sock. He was waiting for his moment to show us this. We've been dunking it under the sink regularly to test it and everything. For example, this is an excellent example. Now, I don't work for this company or anything. I know I'm just wanting to set up a website to sell these things. But this is a sealskin sock. Okay, now people, one of the big things people have against leather socks is they say, you can't wear those, they're so bulky, and you can't wear any shoes on top of it properly, and it's very difficult to wear. So actually, this is another type of sock, which is kind of looks like a dress sock. So this is called a sealskin sock. So now look at it. Does it have its own form? You're never going to see this. This is picture perfect. When I saw this, then my eyes opened up and I said, oh, now I know what the ulama meant by having its own form when it stands on its own. This is the first time I saw that. Number one, this has its own form. See? It's got its own shape. Even though it's a different kind of fabric, it's a very, very thick fabric. Number two, it's waterproof. We put it under the sink and we just squeezed it until we couldn't feel anything. And in fact, when I was studying in Syria with someone named Sheikh Muhammad Yaqubi, many of you probably heard his name, he used to say to me, you have to be able to put your whole foot in water and you shouldn't feel it. You should be able to dump your foot in a bucket when you're wearing a sock that should match the characteristics of leather. So this actually does that. We tried it. And number three, it's thick enough that if you walked on it, it's very thick. It's very thick here down the bottom. If you walked on it, it wouldn't tear. But anyway, I mean, you're not going to see this picture ever again. This is beautiful. This is. Yeah. I mean, I read this so many times, but it didn't hit me the way when he put this up and showed this to me. I said, "Wow, this is. You should put these. You know, like they don't have illustrations in fiqh books, but you should put this one illustration in the fiqh book." So this is actually very, very, very nice example of what we mean by that. That's very important because you know nowadays people they wipe over cotton socks, and you have an ayah of the Quran telling you have to wash your feet. So if you're going to get around that ayah, you better bring a proof that equals the ayah. And the only way we have a proof that equals the ayah is in the case of leather socks. Now, I want to complete the discussion completely. So let me say a couple more things about cotton socks. Number one, all four madhab say you cannot wipe over cotton socks. All four madhab. Imam Abu Hanifa's madhab, Imam Shafi'i's madhab, Imam Malik's madhab, and Imam Ahmad's madhab all agree that you cannot wipe over fabric socks that don't meet the characteristics of leather. So that's the first. Number two, I realize that becomes a problem for people because when you're at work, you don't feel like sticking your foot in the sink. And especially if somebody walks in, it seems kind of weird. So there are ways around it. For example, perhaps one of the ways that I suggest to people is one, these sealskin socks are really nice because they actually meet the characteristics and you can wipe over them. But the other way around it is, look, I've taught you the farad of washing the feet. And the very, very minimum thing that you have to do is you have to wet the foot one time. That's all Allah is asking from you. وَأَرْجُلَكُمْ إِلَى الْكَعْبَيْنِ And wash your foot to the ankle one time. Now the definition of washing within the Sharia the Sharia defines washing as wetting an entire body part such that two drops of water fall from it. That's the minimum definition of washing. So now I've given you the minimum times you have to do it and the minimum that you have to water that you have to put on the foot. So one way to do it is go ahead and make the whole wudu, and at the very end of the wudu, go into the stall. You know, the stall like in the washroom. Just go away from the sink, go into the stall, take your sock off, and you know, just wet a paper towel, squeeze it over your foot, wet the whole foot, and make sure a few decent drops drop off your foot, and your foot will be washed. Just wash it once. You don't need to wash it three times if it's a difficult issue. But there's ways around it if you want, if you're careful and you realize that, you know, what the matter is about. Because it's a big deal. Come on, I mean, your salah is everything. And the wudu is the building up for the basis for the salah. So why screw around with the wudu? The wudu is like one of the most important. There's so many other things you can mess around with, it's not a big deal. But wudu, so important, and one of the important acts that Allah Himself listed in the Holy Book, so we should be very, very careful about how we deal with this matter. For the sake of completeness, let me just complete the whole argument. There are three hadith in the entire collection of all hadith. There are only three hadith which mention wiping over something which is called a jawrab. And a jawrab is very similar to what we might consider a fabric sock. There are only three hadith. Of those three hadith, one of them is narrated by Bilal, radiallahu anhu, and it comes in a book called Mu'jam Saghir Tabrani. Mu'jam al-Saghir of Tabrani. That's one. Number two is narrated by Abu Musa, and it comes in Ibn Majah and Bayhaqi. And number three is narrated by Mughaira ibn Shu'bah, and it comes in Tirmidhi. So there are three hadith which talk about wiping over the jawrab. The first two are by consensus weak. The first two, by the consensus of the ulama, are weak. So those, put those away. So we're left with one hadith. That one single hadith, the third one, some ulama say it's weak, some ulama say it's not weak. So it's debated. So when you look at the whole issue, this one partially, potentially weak hadith, and the two definitely weak hadith, do not have the strength to overturn the certain Qur'an. The Qur'an is certain. That ayah of the Qur'an is 100% certain. And these three hadith, two of which are definitely weak, one of which is possibly weak, does not have the power to reverse an ayah of the Qur'an and allow you to allow exemption from washing the feet. Now, weak hadith are permissible to act upon, but they're not. But only in fada'il, in extra things, in extra credit. Not to overturn an ayah of the Qur'an which is 100% certain. The only reason we permit wiping over leather socks is because there are enough ahadith that it equals the weight of the Qur'an in strength for as a proof. And so therefore we say it's permissible to wipe over leather socks, but for the case of wiping over fabric socks, only two weak hadith and one potentially weak hadith exist, and those hadith do not have the strength to overturn a 100% certain ayah. It's 100% certain that you have to wash your feet. Now that's the complete discussion. Now you've heard all the various aspects of it. We should be very, very careful when we make our wudu that we wash our feet. I mean, I know it's difficult, but believe me, if you work hard, if you realize you can't wipe over your cotton sock, you'll come up with some way to get around it. MashaAllah, all of us are, you know, we have minds, we manage to do things that we need to get done. And so inshallah, I'm confident that you can even do it in this. This is the basis of our salah, and our salah is the basis of everything. I mean, without salah, we're the most lost people in the world. I don't know what else would be the purpose of my life. Maybe somebody else has another purpose in their life, but salah is everything to me. And I'm sure it's for all of you as well, otherwise you wouldn't be here. The reason why I'm presenting this whole issue in so much detail is technically I should have been able to say to you, Imam Abu Hanifa says you can't do it, and everybody should have been content, to tell you the truth. Because we're not scholars. We're not scholars of fiqh. But the reason why I gave you a detailed discussion in this particular instance is because I want you to know that these people were not randomly making up their own opinions. They had reasons. Now, I mean, it's so beautiful when you think about how Imam Abu Hanifa is looking at the entire, all the nas, all the Quran and Hadith, and how he's balancing the different laws. It's very, very beautiful the way that these people came up with these laws. So remember, we are Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah. We are people of the Sunnah, and we follow the Jama'ah. And the Jama'ah of the Ulama has agreed that you cannot wipe over cotton socks. So once that's done, I throw my hands up and surrender. There's nothing more. I don't need to argue with anybody. I mean, the fact that I told you Imam Abu Hanifa or the Hanafi Madhab, which is not only Imam Abu Hanifa, Imam Yusuf, Imam Muhammad, and the hundreds of thousands of other scholars that came after them and verified their work. Once you know that, then it's over. What more do you need? But I gave you the proofs in this particular instance because it's such a common issue, and also because I want you to see how they derive these laws. You know, most people don't talk about this tawatur and all these concepts, but I think you have enough understanding that you can understand what these concepts are, and maybe you won't be able to derive law, but you'll be able to appreciate why we do follow law the way that we follow it. So it's very, very beautifully done. And you can imagine, I mean, if you're just picking up a hadith and reading it in Bukhari, you have no idea what are the other hadith on this subject, what other ayat of the Quran apply here. Does this hadith have tawatur or does it not have tawatur? So there's so many issues, and believe me, I've made this discussion so simple. We could have had a 3-hour discussion just on this issue, and we could have complicated it with so many other ideas within how you derive law. But I've tried to present it in a simple way so that you see that there's a beauty to the way in which law is derived. Now let's just talk about wiping over socks in general. So obviously it's permissible on leather socks only, or socks which meet the characteristics of leather socks. And there's three qualities you need to look for. Number one, should be water resistant. Number two, they should be able to stand on their own with some form. And number three, you should be able to walk a good distance on them without tearing. And that's assumed sand, not concrete. Wiping on leather socks is permissible for both men and women. And what you do when you want to wipe over leather socks or anything similar to a leather sock is you first perform the entire wudu. You'll actually do a full wudu. Once you've done the wudu, then you put the sock on. So you need to be in a state of wudu before you put the sock on. I'm simplifying it a bit. There's some technicalities there, but you need to be in a state of wudu essentially before you put the sock on. Once you put the sock on, then that sock is good for 24 hours. If you are in your home or in your residence, and if you're a traveler, then that sock is good for 72 hours, 3 days and 3 nights. Now, what do we mean by 24 hours? What that means is, once you put the sock on, if you keep that sock on, the moment you break your wudu, the 24-hour clock begins ticking. The moment you break your wudu. So, for example, you put on a sock, you wake up in the morning, you pray, you make wudu, you put on a sock before you go to the masjid, and then you pray fajr in the masjid, and then you drive to work, and then you go to work, and then you actually go pray dhuhr, you still haven't broken your wudu. After dhuhr at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you broke your wudu. Once you broke your wudu, then there is 24 hours, the clock begins ticking, and there are 24 hours during which time you can wipe over those socks. Once 24 hours expires, then you have to remove the sock. Now, some of the students, I was actually discussing this in the morning with some people. There are some people who have mentioned that actually the time doesn't start with the breaking of the wudu, but the time starts with the actual wiping, or the time starts with putting on the sock. And actually, there's some ikhtilaf here and there. For example, Hassan al-Basri used to say that it starts with the time of putting on the sock. And other ulama say it starts with the time of actually wiping the sock, the first time you actually wipe the sock. But I just looked it up in Hidayah. It was written in Hidayah that it starts with the time of the hadath, the time that you actually break your wudu. So once you break, so let's just use that as a standard for this particular class. If you want, you can ask your local scholar, and you can confirm this. I may be mistaken, that may not be Mufta Bihi, but that's the source that I had available to look up right now once the issue was raised. And I mean, I looked in 3 or 4 different books, and it was written the same way in each of those books, in Quduri, in Hidayah, and one other book. But anyway, so there, basically it's 24 hours from the time in which your wudu breaks. So again, if your wudu breaks at 2 o'clock, then you can wear those socks for 24 hours. Now, when you're making wudu with socks, what you'll do is, let's say you put your sock on in a state of wudu and now you want to wipe over it. The way you're going to wipe over it is that you will wet your hands, like you'll do the whole wudu, you'll perform the whole wudu, and then when it comes to the time to wash the feet, instead of washing the feet, you'll simply wet your hands, you take 3 fingers and you run them over the top of the sock, just over the top of the sock, beginning at the toes and wiping up to the shin. The minimum distance is the width of 3 fingers. So if you even just did that and just touched the sock with 3 fingers, you technically would have completed your wiping. But the sunnah is to begin at the toes and wipe all the way up to the shin. So This is actually a very interesting concept because, you know, you would think that you would wipe on the bottom of the sock, because that's the part that's actually, quote-unquote, you know, walking on the ground and this and that. But a lot of times, things within the Sharia are not necessarily rational. And that just highlights the fact that it's the law of Allah. We don't make it up with our own mind. And an excellent example is just think about the things that break wudu. I mean, how unique is wudu that after you pass wind, you wash everything except the place that the wind was passed from and you renew your wudu, right? So when you, if you have wudu and you pass wind, then you have to wash your arms, your face, wipe your head, wash your feet, but you don't have to wash the area where the wind was passed from. So it goes to show you that sometimes it's not really based on, you know, we don't rationally come up with these laws, but that's the way Allah made it, and we're servants. When you're a servant, you don't ask a question, you just do it. That's the way, that's part of being a servant. This really highlights some important concepts within the deen, and that is that our primary source in the deen is the Qur'an and the Sunnah. That's how we come up with these laws. They're derived from the Qur'an and the Sunnah. The actual ability to wipe on the sock can expire with two things. One is if you remove the sock, or two is with the expiration of the 24-hour period, for example, if you're a muqim, if you're a resident, or 72 hours if you're a traveler. Now, the next thing to keep in mind is that if you, for example, if your sock expires, the time of your sock expires and you're in a state of wudu, the only thing you have to do is wash your feet and then you can replace the sock on your foot. So if the time expires and you're in a state of wudu, you just go ahead and take the sock off, wash your foot, and put it back on. The last thing that comes under this discussion is masha over the turban, the cap, the veil, if a woman wears a veil, over gloves, if a woman wears a glove, and again. Now, there are various ahadith in the collection of hadith which talk about the Prophet ﷺ wiping over a turban. The thing is, the exact same issue that we talked about with leather socks. The Quran is saying you have to wipe your head, clear cut, with certainty. And the hadith where it speak of the Prophet ﷺ wiping over the turban, they are not at the level of the Quran in proof. They are single transmissions. They might be sahih, but they are single transmissions, and so therefore they cannot equate with the level of the Holy Quran. Therefore, we do not permit wiping over the turban, for example. Then the question should be, well, how can we have some sahih hadith which allow you to wipe over it, which would say the Prophet ﷺ wiped over a turban? Well, our answer will be twofold. Number one, the Prophet ﷺ, most of the time when he made wudu, already had a state of wudu. He used to make wudu upon wudu. So number one, we'll say that those narrations actually refer to a time when the Prophet ﷺ already had wudu, and so he was just washing body parts in order to renew the wudu, but when it came to the turban, he would just simply wipe over it because he already was in a state of wudu, so it wasn't necessary to wipe the one for. That's the first answer we would give. The second answer we would give is that the Prophet ﷺ, when he would wipe over the turban, would wipe like this, a little bit of the head and the rest of the turban. And don't forget, only one-fourth of the head is mandatory, correct? So that's the two ways that we'll explain those hadith in order for everything to fit in the picture together. The ayah and the hadith. Everything has to fit together. You know, it's not that we're going to reject that hadith, but we're going to say the ayah is dominant. The ayah is qati. So many sahaba from so many different chains of transmission on so many different occasions are narrating this ayah, whereas these hadith are not as common. A few sahaba may have narrated them, and so therefore the Quran takes dominance. And we'll explain the hadith in light of the Quran. The last thing is that there, in the case of, for example, there's another issue of wiping, and that is wiping over a cast or wiping over a bandage. You have a wound and you actually have like a cloth covering it. So in those cases, if let's say you have a cast and you need to perform wudu, then all you do is wipe over the entire cast. Now the big question people will have, and they'll call me and they'll say, well, I need to get a cast. Should I do wudu before I put the cast on? Right? Because in the case of a sock, you have to have wudu before you put the sock on. Or if they get the cast on, they say, should I get my cast cut and make wudu and then get the cast put back on? And the answer is you don't have to be in a state of wudu for the sake of the cast. Only for the sock. Only for the leather sock. So if you have a cast on, whether you were in a state of wudu or you weren't in a state of wudu, you can wipe over that cast. Same thing if you have like some sort of bandage or something covering a wound. Now keep in mind that sometimes we put on a band-aid or something like that in order to cover a wound which really doesn't need to be covered. So somebody, for example, will, you know, press like a pimple and something will come out and they don't want anyone to see it, so they put a band-aid on it, but it does, you know, water wouldn't harm it at all. In that case, you have to wash what's underneath the band-aid. You're only permitted to wipe over that bandage when it would harm you if you removed it.
Okay? So keep that in mind. That's a mistake that people might make, which could potentially interfere with our performance of wudu. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The next section is on ghusl. And actually, the central ayah in the Holy Quran to discuss ghusl is وَإِن كُنْتُمْ جُنُوبًا فَطَّهَّرُوا. And if you are in a state of major ritual impurity, فَطَّهَّرُوا, extensively purify yourself. This is also it's ayah 6 of Surah Ma'idah. So this is also right in that same ayah as wudu. Now remember that the body enters into two states of ritual impurity. Either you enter major ritual impurity, or either you enter minor ritual impurity, which in Arabic is called al-hadath al-asghar. So minor ritual impurity. And that happens when you break your wudu. So if you vomit a mouthful, or you use the washroom, or you pass gas, etc., all those things will break your wudu. And so that enters you into a state of minor ritual impurity. And in order to remove that, you have to make wudu, and then you re-enter the state of purity. You can again touch the Quran. You can again begin to pray. So the second type of impurity is called major ritual impurity. And major ritual impurity is actually called in Arabic al-hadath al-akbar, major ritual impurity. And it's caused by one of four things. Number one, hayd, meaning a woman's monthly cycle. Number two, nifas, the bleeding after childbirth. Number three, the insertion of the male private part into a female's private part. So with insertion, with or without release of fluid, that causes a state of major ritual impurity. And number four, the release of fluid in the state of excitement from the male private part. For example, secondary to like a vision, if somebody has a vision or a dream while they're sleeping and then with excitement they release fluid, that also causes a major state of major ritual impurity. It can happen to women as well. Now that major state of ritual impurity, in order to get out of that state, you need to perform a ghusl. This is what ghusl is. And ghusl can be translated as ritual bath if you want to. It's not just an average bath that you take, but it's a special type of bath that you extensively purify yourself. وَإِن كُنْتُمْ جُنُوبًا. And if you are in major ritual impurity, فَطَّهَّرُوا. This is a siga of emphasis. This is a verb form of emphasis. فَطَّهَّرُوا. Really purify yourselves. So when you're in a state of major ritual impurity, there are three major things that you cannot do. Number one, you cannot touch or read the Holy Quran. You cannot touch or read the Holy Quran. Now, when you didn't have wudu, when you were in minor ritual impurity, you could read it, but you couldn't touch it. In this case, you cannot touch it and you cannot read it. Number two, you cannot pray. And number three, you cannot enter the masjid. Three things. Number one, you cannot touch or read the Holy Quran. Number two, you cannot pray. And number three, you cannot enter the masjid. Remember that if a woman is in her cycle or she's having bleeding after childbirth, then she won't fast, correct? The fact that she doesn't fast is not because she's in a state of major ritual impurity. It's because of the fact that she's having her bleeding. So keep that in mind. If you are in a state of major ritual impurity and the fast time comes upon you, you can enter the fast in that state. Alright? So major ritual impurity does not block fasting. It'll become a problem at the time of Fajr when you want to pray, but it does not block you from fasting. So in the same thing with a woman, the thing that blocks her from fasting is the bleeding, the monthly cycle or the bleeding after childbirth. And the same thing with the case of having relations with your wife, conjugal relations with your wives. If, for example, she is in a state of hayd and she is in a state of nifas, then you cannot have relations with your wife. Alright? You can't have relations with your wife. And so for example, she's in a state of hayd and you can't have relations with your wife. That's not because of her state of major ritual impurity, it's because of the hayd. If somebody's in a state of just major ritual impurity, that does not prohibit having relations. So there are three things that you cannot do in a state of major ritual impurity. Number one, touch or read the Holy Quran. Number two, pray. And number three, enter the masjid. Let me touch on number three for a moment. It's got to be a masjid proper that you cannot enter. And this kind of gets iffy and it kind of becomes, it really requires you to get a fatwa for your particular scenario. But, I learned this lesson when I was teaching once in the gym at MEC, and I was teaching the exact same subject, and some of the sisters had come and they were in that state. And I had said, you can't enter the masjid, and I had assumed that that gym would count as a masjid for those times that we pray in there, and we set it up as a masjid. But actually, that doesn't count as a masjid, that counts as a musalla.
There are specific requirements that are necessary to be met to call something a masjid. And until you meet those requirements, that will not be called a masjid. That's a gymnasium. That's a musalla. It's not a masjid. And so you need to fulfill certain requirements. If you have questions, you can send it to Muftis and get the answers and more details, inshallah. Now, the state of major ritual impurity is relieved or removed by ghusl. وَإِن كُنْتُمْ جُنُوبًا فَطَّهَرُوا. And if you are in a state of janaba, of major ritual impurity, then extensively purify yourselves. So there are three mandatory things that have to occur in order for you to extensively purify yourself. Number one, you have to wash. What you have to do is wash everything that you can get water to. That's your job. Everything that you can easily get water to, you have to wash as mandatory in ghusl. So, number one, you have to get water up to the back of your throat. Number two, you have to get water to the soft bone. And number three, you have to get water over your entire body. Your hair, your every single bit of your body has to become wet, including the navel. So people often miss the navel. Everything that you can get water to easily. Now, that doesn't mean you need to flip your eyelid upside down and drop water on it, okay? That's what we mean by getting water easily. Where you can get water easily, like you can easily wash the back of your throat, you can easily wash to the soft bone in the nose, you can easily wash get the entire body wet. So those become the fara'id, the necessary factors of within the ghusl. The other thing to keep in mind is people sometimes ask the question, well, I had used the bathroom, so I got into a state of minor ritual impurity and I needed to make wudu. And then something happened which then put me in major ritual impurity. So do I need to do wudu and ghusl, or can I just do the ghusl? And the answer is, the ghusl removes both minor and major impurity. So if you perform the ghusl, you now have cleared both. So you don't need to perform wudu and ghusl. However, at the same time, the sunnah method of performing ghusl actually involves wudu. When you want to make ghusl according to the sunnah, you'll do the following things. Number one, you'll make a niyyah. And the niyyah will be to remove yourself from major ritual impurity. Number two, you'll wash your hands to your wrist. And again, this is the same concept. You're preparing the hands to then clean the rest of the body. Number three, you wash the private parts. Even if there's najasa on there or there's no najasa on there, regardless of whether you see impurity on the private parts, it's sunnah to wash the private parts at this time. Then number four, you will look for najasa anywhere else on the body and wash it. Or you can wash the entire body over, but you'll look for, if you specifically see there's some najasa, for example, on your stomach, there's something impure, if there's some, you know, fluid that's stuck on your stomach, then you'll wash that away. You have to get rid of that. And then next you'll perform the wudu. So you'll actually perform the wudu as if you were performing the wudu. So you'll wash everything that you would in wudu exactly the way you would with the sunnah wudu. And then finally, you'll pour water over your head three times, then pour water over the right side of your body three times, rubbing the body to make sure everything gets wet, and then pour water over the left side of your body three times, rubbing the body to make sure the entire body gets wet. So every bit of scalp has to get wet. Every base of the hair has to get wet. Every bit of skin has to get wet. The navel, inside the navel has to get water. Not all the way in, but the outside has to get water. So that's how you perform the ghusl. And also be careful of the teeth. If you have something stuck in your teeth, that has to be removed because the teeth are part of the ghusl. Now if you have a cavity or a filling or something like that, or braces, then that you can just wash over the braces. It's not a problem. But if you have something that's easily removable, like some food stuck on your teeth, you need to make sure that you get soap, you know, that you clean your mouth properly beforehand so that water gets to the teeth as well. This is the sunnah way of doing it. I'm going to share with you just some wisdom behind it. And that is that the ayah says, وَإِن كُنْتُمْ جُنُوبًا فَطَّهَّرُوا. Really purify yourselves. So the sunnah actually does it in a beautiful way, because wudu is the essential means of purifying yourself. It's the essential way. So what the sunnah does, if you want to think of it this way, is it tells you to purify yourself according to wudu and then do something extra beyond it. So this act is highlighting again that wudu is the essential, you know, purification means for us. And when we're in major ritual impurity, we add something to the wudu. The wudu still forms the base, but the only thing we add is that the entire then body has to be washed. Because in the wudu, you're going to gargle to the back of your throat and you're going to wash to the soft bone if you do a proper wudu. So then you're just building on that wudu and washing the rest of the body. So that's a beautiful way of looking at it. وَإِن كُنْتُمْ جُنُوبًا فَطَّهَّرُوا.